shaping the need for hydrogen-powered cars, which produce only water as an end product of combustion, or even solar-powered vehicles. So far, the Japanese lean producers have not failed at epical innovations of this sort. They simply haven't tried, occupying themselves instead with a brilliant scavenging process that has scanned the technological landscape for ideas nearly ready for the market, as in the case of the high-tech four-cylinder engines of the 1980s. A much more difficult challenge probably lies just ahead. Chapter 6. Coordinating the Supply Chain. The modern car is almost unimaginably complicated. As we noted, a typical model is made up of more than 10,000 parts, each of which must be designed and made by someone. Organizing this enormous task is probably the greatest challenge in manufacturing a motor vehicle, yet it is the one least understood and appreciated by the outside world. Henry Ford thought he had solved the problem by the time of World War I. Do it all yourself in your own company. However, his solution raised as many questions as it answered. How do you organize and coordinate hundreds of thousands of employees in hundreds of factories and engineering offices? What do you do with your machines and factories, all dedicated to making specific parts for your own products, when demand shifts or the economy goes sour? This chapter is based primarily on the research of Toshihiro Nishiguchi and Richard Lamming. In the 1920s, Alfred Sloan found one answer to these problems. Do it all in your own company, but set up decentralized parts-making divisions as independent profit centers. For example, Harrison Radiator, Saginaw Steering, AC Spark Plug, to make specific categories of parts for the whole company. By treating the divisions as independent businesses, Sloan thought, he could impose the cost and efficiency discipline of the market while preserving the coordination advantages of a unified company. Sloan had a solution to the problem of the cyclical car market as well. When the market slumps, lay off workers in the supply system, just as you lay off workers in the assembly plant. By the 1950s, the Ford Motor Company under Henry Ford II had a new idea, which, as it turned out, was actually an old idea. Ford put out to bid to completely independent supplier firms many categories of components formerly supplied from within the company. The suppliers were given detailed drawings of the necessary parts and asked for their price per part. The lowest bidder generally won a one-year contract. When the market slumped, these suppliers were laid off by means of canceled contracts, just like workers. This was, in fact, the world Ford had left around 1913, the world of arm's-length, market-based, short-term interactions with independent businesses. In the 1980s, mass production companies around the world were using both approaches. GM was the most integrated, with about 70% of the parts in each car and truck supplied by its in-house parts divisions. Saab, at the opposite extreme, made only about 25% of its parts, always preserving for itself just those parts most visible to the consumer, the body and the engine. How much each company actually integrated was a function of the company's history and its size. The enormous investment GM had sunk into its parts operations made it very hard to think about alternatives, while Saab was simply too small to make all its own parts. Indeed, a key justification of the Ford purchase of Jaguar and of the GM joint venture with Saab had been that Jaguar and Saab can obtain cheaper parts through the greater bargaining power of a larger producer, and can share some common parts, such as switches and lights, with Ford and GM, respectively. However, neither system, in-house or arm's length, works very well. In the mid-1980s, in the twilight of mass production, many companies, including General Motors and Chrysler, experimented with reducing the fraction of parts they obtained from their in-house suppliers. This tactic was inspired by a belief that lower wages in outside supplier companies were the competitive secret of the Japanese supply systems. In our view, this change in direction, now on hold at Chrysler and GM because of resistance by middle management and the UAW, largely misses the point. The key to a competitive parts supply system is the way the assembler, for example Ford or Renault or Toyota, works with its suppliers, for example Ford's automotive trim operations or Bendix, Renault's transmissions division or Valeo, Toyota's engine division or Nippon Denso. Whether the supplier comes from inside the company or out makes surprisingly little difference. To see why this is so, let's pick up where we left off in Chapter 5 and follow the component supply process as it has worked, and in many cases still works, in mass production car companies. We'll trace the system from the moment it begins in the design of a new car. Mature mass production. Designing the parts. Remember that the design process in a mass production company proceeds in a sequence, one step at a time. First, the overall concept for the new model is specified by the assembler's product planning team and reviewed by senior management. Then the product is planned in detail, down to the fraction of an inch, for example, the wheelbase and track, and the specific type of material to be used for each part, for example, steel fenders, plastic steering wheel, aluminum engine. Next, detailed engineering drawings are made for each part, specifying the precise materials to be used. Steel of a given gauge with double galvanized coating for the fenders, for example. Thermoset plastic with carbon fiber reinforcements for the steering wheel. Specific aluminum alloy for the engine block, and so forth. Only at this point are the organizations that will actually make the parts called in. These typically number between 1,000 and 2,500 for the complete car, including independent companies and in-house parts divisions. When the suppliers, whether in-house or independents, finally get the call, they are shown the drawings and asked for bids. For example, they're asked, what will the cost per steering wheel be for 400,000 steering wheels per year? The mass production assembler also sets a quality target, so many bad parts per 1,000 as the acceptable upper limit, and a delivery schedule, perhaps one or two times a week, with a penalty for failure to deliver on time or in the right quantity. The term of the contract is generally quite short, usually a year for parts that require new capital investment, but even less for those commodity parts, such as batteries or tires, that most companies in the industry buy from the same suppliers and that are already in production. So price, quality, delivery, reliability, and contract length become the four key elements of the assembler-supplier relationship. When the suppliers see the drawings, they know from long experience that they are involved in a complex game, where none of the real rules are written into the bid tender. They realize that the assembler's procurement office is under tremendous pressure to reduce costs. Cost comes first is an assembler's byword. So quoting a low price per part is absolutely essential to a winning bid. However, the suppliers are also aware that follow-on business for a new model can often extend for 10 years. Then there's the market for replacement parts, which may be considerably longer. So in reality, they are not bidding on a one-year contract, but potentially on a stream of business running for 20 years. Since this is the case, should they bid below cost? Doing so is tempting, because the supplier's experience also tells them that once a part is in production, with acceptable quality and delivery performance, they may be able to go back to the assembler for a cost adjustment. We can't get our steel in the net shape we need, so scrap costs are running above our estimates, they may say, meaning that the only steel blanks they can get are too big, so they must cut off more to get the size of part they need, a process that entails extra initial cost and waste. Or, our union is insisting on work rule changes that are increasing our costs. Or, the new machine we bought to mold steering wheels cannot provide adequate quality without hand finishing. In addition, there exists a long tradition of the annual cost adjustment for for follow-on contracts, designed to allow for general inflation. The assembler tends to grant these adjustments across the board without investigating individual circumstances. To look into each case would simply require too much effort. Of course, suppliers are almost certain actually to reduce production costs over time, since as time goes on, they gain experience in producing the part. So the annual cost increase in subsequent years may turn a money-losing initial bid into money-making follow-on business. Finally, for some parts requiring heavy investments in new production tools, the assembler may find it extremely costly and inconvenient to obtain a new supplier once production is in full swing. Suppliers of these parts may gamble that their ability to raise prices will grow over time. This mindset makes the temptation to buy the business, that is, put in a deliberately lower bid in order to get a foot in the door, almost irresistible. The mass production assembler has played this game thousands of times and fully expects the successful bidders to come back later for price adjustments. Thus, it is important for the assembler's product designers to have some idea of suppliers' real costs so they can accurately estimate price adjustments downstream. It's hard work, though. A key feature of market-based bidding is that suppliers share only a single piece of information with the assembler, the bid price per part. Otherwise, suppliers jealously guard information about their operations, even when they are divisions of the assembler company. By holding back information on how they plan to make the part and on their internal efficiency, they believe they are maximizing their ability to hide profits from the assembler. Once the assembler designates the winning bidders, the suppliers set to work making prototype parts. This process is likely to uncover many problems because the traditional mass producer farms out the many parts in a complex component to many suppliers who may have no direct contact with each other. For example, until recently, General Motors built practically all its own seats by ordering about 25 parts per seat from as many suppliers. When the parts were finally put together in the finished seat, it was not surprising that a piece wouldn't fit or that two abutting materials would prove incompatible. For example, they might rattle or squeak in cold weather because of different expansion coefficients. Once the supplier tests the parts and components, and the assembler, in turn, tests the components in complete vehicles, the assembler specifies necessary changes in each part and gives the sign-off to begin volume production. However, the mass production assembler is still not through with the supplier selection process. Mature mass production, supplying the parts. At this point, the purchasing department is worrying less about getting the vehicle into production and more about how to control costs among suppliers whose operations it only vaguely understands. The obvious way to do so is to identify additional suppliers for each part and give them the final production-ready drawings as the basis for making bids. The suppliers who already have been selected are horrified, of course, which is precisely the idea. The initial supplier also feels cheated, because the new bidder will not have to bear the cost of fine-tuning the original drawings. Of course, the first supplier has also played this particular game countless times before, and has probably left some room in its bid to make adjustments in subsequent years, as the assembler plays two or even three or four suppliers against each other. What's more, many of the assembler's threats to seek an alternative source may turn out empty, particularly when they are directed at in-house suppliers. Let's take the example of one of GM's in-house suppliers. We'll imagine that the program manager for a new GM product is unhappy with the in-house supplier's bid. It's too high, and in the past, the supplier had quality and delivery problems. However, no sooner does the manager identify an alternative bidder outside the company than the in-house supplier goes to corporate headquarters and explains that loss of business on this part will require an increase in the cost of similar parts already being supplied for other GM products. Why? Because economies of scale will be lost and the in-house supplier will have excess capacity. headquarters, always very respectful of scale economy and capacity utilization justifications in a mass production firm such as GM, then has a talk with the program manager. The in-house supplier makes solemn promises to try harder to reduce costs in the future while improving quality and delivery reliability, and gets the business. In this way, the internal market, which supposedly keeps the in-house supply divisions honest, is gradually diluted. This process explains how GM managed to have both the world's highest production volume and the world's highest costs in many of its component supply divisions through much of the last decade. At the end of the selection process, the assembler usually ends up with a single supplier for the most complex and technologically advanced components, such as engine computers. For commodity parts, such as tires, three or four suppliers are often put under contract. However, designating the complete roster of suppliers and beginning volume production is only the end of the first stage of assembler-supplier collaboration on a new product. Immediately after a new model reaches the market, a lengthy process of debugging begins, entailing intense interaction between the assembler and its suppliers. Despite years of testing of prototypes, the assembler often discovers from initial consumer feedback that something is not right. Either a part doesn't work at all, or buyers complain that it doesn't work well. For example, a new model's brakes work properly, but squeak when they are cold. The solution? A running change, which in this case involves substituting a new brake pad material on the production line at the earliest possible moment. In the 1980s, many Western companies introduced thousands of running changes in the first year or two of a new model's life. Each of these may have required renegotiating the supplier contracts, which meant cost increases for the assembler. Another aspect of debugging involves manufacturability. The assembly plant may report that workers find it nearly impossible to attach a part properly because of its design, or perhaps there are simply too many parts in a given area of the vehicle, 10 when one should do, say. The only solution may be to redesign the part or the entire component, a step assemblers almost never took before the 1980s, because it's expensive, but one they have taken more frequently in recent years as the demand for quality has grown, along with awareness of the manufacturing cost penalty of an improperly designed component over the production life of a model. Finally, the supplier may fail to meet quality targets. Remember that the mass producer expresses these targets as an acceptable percentage of bad parts. When the assembler finds fewer than the acceptable number of bad parts, typically by inspecting parts as they are delivered to the assembly plant, they are tossed in the waste bin or sent back for a credit. Only when the number of defective parts goes above the acceptable level does the assembler do something dramatic. Send the whole shipment back, say, and refuse payment. Even in this case, it's strictly the supplier's responsibility to find the problem and correct it. Most suppliers believe strongly that what goes on in my factory is my own business. Assembler meddling in supplier production problems is distinctly unwelcome because it could uncover valuable data on the supplier's operations and costs, information that the assembler could use to bargain down prices for follow-on contracts. The supplier-assembler relationship can remain conflicted even once a new model is fully debugged. If competition is unexpectedly stiff, for example, production may never reach the planned volume. So costs increase, even as pressure grows to cut prices. The assembler may be tempted to look for sources at lower cost, even outside the companies already under contract. Suppliers who have just tooled up and who are, in fact, selling below cost may then be dumped for a lower bidder. This step no doubt cuts costs in the short term, but reconfirms all suppliers, including the new winners, in the belief that information must be guarded from the assembler, and that any trust placed in a long-term relationship is trust misplaced. As if these hurdles weren't enough, there's the problem of fluctuating volume. As we'll see in Chapter 9, the major auto markets of the mass producers, particularly in North America, tend to be highly cyclical. There may also be rapid shifts in the mix of products that consumers demand, even when the total number of cars and trucks sold is stable. The mass production assembler takes the position that these shifts are unpredictable and that parts orders may have to be canceled on sudden notice. Any oversupply of parts that may result is the supplier's problem. What's more, mass production suppliers tend to have very large stocks and both finished parts and parts in process. Suppliers, therefore, build overstock contingencies into their bids, and in the end, the consumer pays for the erratic flow of business. As should be clear by now, the mature mass production supply system is broadly unsatisfactory to everyone concerned. The suppliers are brought in late in the design process and can do little to improve the design, which may be hard and expensive to manufacture. They are under intense cost pressure from a buyer who does not understand their special problems. As a result, implausible bids win contracts, followed by adjustments, which can make the cost per part higher than those of realistic but losing bidders. This process makes estimating costs accurately difficult for the assembler. Moreover, the effort to play bidders off against each other makes them very reluctant to share ideas on improved production techniques while a part is in production. In other words, they have no incentive to merge their learning curves. At best, the typical mass production supply system can succeed in keeping the supplier's profits very low. The assembler's purchasing department may cite this fact as the primary evidence of its success. However, parts costs, a very different matter from supplier profits, may remain very high, and quality may prove both unsatisfactory and resistant to improvement, all because no one really communicates with anyone else. Surely there is a better way. Component supply in lean production. There is a better way. Again, we travel to Japan to find it. To see just how that system works, let's return to the Shusa-led product development process we looked at in Chapter 5. At the very outset of product development, the lean producer selects all the necessary suppliers. The leading Japanese lean producers involve fewer than 300 suppliers in each project, compared with 1,000 to 2,500 at Western mass producers. These suppliers are easy to designate because they are typically the companies supplying the same parts for the producer's other models and are long-term members of the assembler's supplier group. We'll explain the nature of these groups shortly. Significantly, they are not selected on the basis of bids, but rather on the basis of past relationships and a proven record of performance. A third to an eighth as many suppliers are involved compared with a mass production company, because lean producers assign a whole component, for example, seats, to what they call a first-tier supplier. The supplier is in charge of delivering complete seats to the assembly plant. In consequence, Nissan, for example, has only one seating supplier for its new Infiniti Q45 model, while GM, in many cases, is still dealing with 25 suppliers providing the 25 needed parts to the seat-building department of its assembly plants. The first-tier supplier typically has a team of second-tier suppliers, independent companies that are manufacturing specialists. These companies may, in turn, engage helpers in a third or even fourth tier of the supply pyramid. These later companies make individual parts according to drawings supplied by the second-tier firm. We looked at the historical origins of this system in Chapter 3. The first-tier suppliers to a lean development program assign staff members, called resident design engineers, to the development team shortly after the planning process starts and 2 to 3 years prior to production. As product planning is completed, with continuous input from the supplier's engineers, different areas of the car, suspension, electrical system, lighting, climate control, seating, steering, and so forth, are turned over to that area's supplier specialist to engineer in detail. The first-tier suppliers, then, have full responsibility for designing and making component systems that perform to the agreed-upon performance specification in the finished car. The supplier's development team, with its own SHUSA, with the help of resident design engineers from the assembler company and the second-tier suppliers, then conducts detailed development and engineering. In 1988, for example, Nissin Kogyo, a leading Japanese brake manufacturer, had a product development team of 7 engineers, 2 cost analysts, and a liaison person regularly positioned at Honda's research and development center. The team was working on a daily basis with Honda's development engineers on the design of a new Honda car. The nature of the supply arrangements means that the assembler may actually know relatively little about certain parts or systems. We interviewed the head of one Western supplier who had recently become the seating supplier to one of the Japanese transplants in North America. To get started, he had flown to Tokyo and asked the assembler for a detailed set of engineering drawings so he could prepare a bid. However, the assembler explained that he knew very little about the technical aspects of seating and certainly had no drawings. These are entirely the responsibility of our 2 traditional suppliers of seating. You will have to ask them, he said. In the end, the Western company formed a joint venture with one of the Japanese suppliers to supply the North American transplant. The lean assembler doesn't delegate to the supplier the detailed design of certain parts considered vital to the success of the car, due either to proprietary technology or to the consumer's perception of the product. Leading examples of parts usually reserved for the assembler's in-house supply divisions are engines, transmissions, major body panels, and increasingly, the electronic management systems that coordinate the activities of many vehicle systems. Even when it comes to parts where the assembler is only loosely acquainted with the technology and totally dependent on a single outside supplier, the lean producer takes care to learn an enormous amount about the supplier's production costs and quality. But what is it about this system that allows an interchange of such sensitive information to take place? The answer is simple. The system works only because a rational framework exists for determining costs, price, and profits. This framework makes the two parties want to work together for mutual benefit, rather than look upon one another with mutual suspicion. Almost all the relationships between supplier and assembler are conducted within the context of a so-called basic contract. The contract is, on the one hand, simply an expression of the assemblers and suppliers' long-term commitment to work together. However, it also establishes ground rules for determining prices, as well as quality assurance, ordering and delivery, proprietary rights, and material supply. In short, the contract lays the basis for a cooperative relationship, one that is fundamentally different from the relatively adversarial relationships between supplier and assembler in the West. Similar contracts have also been commonplace between first and second tier suppliers in Japan since the 1960s. Lean supply in practice. Let's now take a closer look at how the supplier-assembler relationship works in practice. At the heart of lean supply lies a different system of establishing prices and jointly analyzing costs. First, the lean assembler establishes a target price for the car or truck, and then, with the suppliers, works backwards, figuring how the vehicle can be made for this price while allowing a reasonable profit for both the assembler and the suppliers. In other words, it is a market price minus system rather than a supplier cost plus system. To achieve this target cost, both the assembler and the supplier use value engineering techniques to break down the costs of each stage of production, identifying each factor that could lower the cost of each part. Once value engineering is completed, the first tier supplier designated to design and make each component then enters into mutual bargaining with the assembler, not on the price, but on how to reach the target and still allow a reasonable profit for the supplier. This process is the opposite of the mass production approach in price determination. Once the part is in production, in lean production, a technique called value analysis is used to achieve further cost reductions. Value analysis, which continues the entire time the part is being produced, is again a technique for analyzing the costs of each production step in detail, so that cost-critical steps can be identified and targeted for further work to reduce costs still further. These savings may be achieved by incremental improvements or Kaizen, the introduction of new tooling, or the redesign of the part. Of course, all producers, mass and lean, try to analyze costs. But lean production makes it much easier to do this accurately. Where setup times have been honed always to require only a few minutes, and where production runs are frequent, short, and uninterrupted, cost estimators do not have to wait around for days or weeks to average the performance over several production runs. They can quickly collect data that is accurate and representative. Indeed, collecting the data can be left to the machine operators themselves. This makes it possible to do a complete cost analysis several times a year and to monitor progress in cutting costs accurately. Obviously, for the lean approach to work, the supplier must share a substantial part of its proprietary information about costs and production techniques. The assembler and the supplier go over every detail of the supplier's production process, looking for ways to cut costs and improve quality. In return, the assembler must respect the supplier's need to make a reasonable profit. Agreements between the assembler and supplier on sharing profits give suppliers the incentive to improve the production process because it guarantees that the supplier keeps all the profits derived from its own cost-saving innovations and Kaizen activities. A second feature of lean supply is continually declining prices over the life of a model. While mass producers assume that bidders are actually selling below cost at the outset of a contract and will expect to recoup their investment by raising prices year by year, lean producers assume, or rather know, that the price for the first year's production is a reasonable estimate of the supplier's actual cost plus profit. The assemblers are also well aware of the learning curve that exists for producing practically any item. So they realize that costs should fall in subsequent years, even though raw material costs and wages increase somewhat. Improvements in lean production companies should, in fact, come much faster. That is, learning curves should be much steeper than in mass production companies because of Kaizen, the continuous incremental improvement in the production process. The question is, who realizes the savings? Again, through mutual discussion and bargaining, the assembler and supplier agree on a cost reduction curve over the 4-year life of the product, with the proviso that any supplier-derived cost savings beyond those agreed upon will go to the supplier. This is the principal mechanism in the lean supply system for encouraging suppliers to engage in rapid and continuous improvement. Here's an example of how the process works. Say the price of a part, such as an instrument cluster, is set at 1,200 yen the first year of production. Say, too, that through the joint efforts of the assembler and supplier, a cost of 1,100 yen is achieved in the first year. In this case, the assembler pays the supplier 1,150 yen the first year. The assembler and supplier share the profit. Now, say the supplier, through its own efforts, comes up with another innovation that further reduces the price in the first year to 1,080 yen. The supplier would keep the balance and still receive 1,150 yen. The same process would apply in the 3 subsequent years. By agreeing to share the profits from joint activities and letting suppliers keep the profits from additional activities they undertake, the assembler relinquishes the right to monopolize the benefits of the supplier's ideas, benefits Western suppliers would be horrified to give up. On the other hand, the Japanese assembler gains from the increased willingness of its suppliers to come up with innovations and cost-saving suggestions and to work collaboratively. The system replaces a vicious circle of mistrust with a virtuous circle of cooperation. Once the component is designed and production begins, additional differences appear between mass and lean supply. For one, lean production has few running changes for the simple reason that the new car or truck tends to work the way it is supposed to. Another important difference is the way components are delivered to the assembler. It is now almost universally the practice in the best lean production companies to deliver components directly to the assembly line, often hourly, certainly several times a day, with no inspection at all of incoming parts. This procedure is in keeping with the famous just-in-time system, the invention of Taichi Ono. To make just-in-time work at all, a system in which empty parts boxes sent from the assembler back to the supplier are the signal to make more parts, yet another innovation of lean production is essential: production smoothing. Lean production, as we'll consider in more detail in Chapter 9, is characterized by extraordinary flexibility in shifting the mix of products manufactured, and doing so on only a few hours' notice. At the same time, the system is extremely sensitive to fluctuations in the total volume of cars and trucks made. These types of shifts are very difficult to accommodate in a system in which employees, because of job guarantees, are a fixed cost. So Toyota and other practitioners of lean production work very hard at Heijunka, production smoothing, in which the total volume the assembler manufactures is kept as constant as possible. The aggressive selling system we'll look at in the next chapter largely makes the success of Heijunka possible in the Japanese domestic market, while in export markets, the Japanese lean producers have enjoyed a cost or quality advantage for 30 years. This has made it possible to cut prices during market slumps in order to keep production volume steady. The Japanese have another motive for practicing production smoothing. They want to ensure a steady volume of business for the suppliers. That way, the suppliers can utilize employees and machinery much more effectively than in the West, where they are constantly faced with sudden changes in the volume and mix of orders at very short notice. These unannounced changes by the assembler are the cause of Western suppliers holding unnecessary stocks. They feel they must buffer themselves against sudden surges in ordering by the assemblers. After all, if you have constantly varying orders from the assembler and also need to make prompt deliveries, there's only one solution. You must make complete parts in expectation of orders and keep lots of raw materials on hand. In Japan, assemblers give suppliers advance notice of changes in volume. If the changes are likely to persist, the assembler will work with the supplier to look for other businesses. The assembler will not, as in the West, suddenly pull such activities in-house so it can keep its own staff working. In Japan, there is a commitment to share the bad times as well as the good. Suppliers are, to a considerable extent, considered fixed costs, like the assembler's employees. Of course, even the best components supply system occasionally comes up with a dud, and even for the best lean producers, zero defects is a goal rather than a reality. However, a final important difference between mass and lean supply emerges once a defect is found. In old-fashioned mass production systems, the assembler's parts checkers at the receiving dock usually spot components problems. As we saw, when the defects are few, these parts are simply discarded or returned for a credit. When they are numerous, the whole shipment may be rejected and returned. Doing so is feasible because the assembler typically has a week or more of parts already on hand and can easily continue production while waiting for an acceptable shipment. The lean producer has a very different attitude. With no reserve stocks, a faulty shipment could prove catastrophic. In the worst case, the entire assembly plant with its 2,500 workers might grind to a halt. Yet this disaster almost never happens in practice, despite the fact that parts are not inspected until they are actually installed on the car or truck. Why not? For two reasons. The parts supplier knows what faulty parts can mean and takes pains not to let it happen. As one supplier remarked to us, "We work without a safety net, so we can't afford to fall off the high wire. We don't." And in the rare event a defective part is found, the assembler's quality control department goes rapidly through what Toyota calls the five whys. Both the supplier and the assembler are determined to trace every defective part to its ultimate cause and to ensure that a solution is devised that prevents this error from ever happening again. The supplier, very likely, will have a resident engineer in the assembly plant to work on problems. If the engineer can't sort out what's wrong, the assembler's engineers take a trip to the supplier's plant. This visit, however, is not an inquisition. Rather, the trip is more like a bilateral problem-solving mission. In the world of mass production, the supplier might flatly forbid these field visits. "My plant is my business," is a typical supplier response in the West. By contrast, lean supply agreements in Japan always provide for plant access by assembler personnel. Let's look at what might happen when they arrive. First, they discover that the defective part has been caused by a machine that cannot hold a proper tolerance. But the machine isn't the ultimate cause. So the team asks, "Why can't this machine hold tolerance?" The supplier's personnel report that it's because the machine operators cannot be adequately trained. The team members ask, "Why?" The supplier answers that it's because these employees keep quitting to look for other work, which means the operators are always novices. "Why do workers keep quitting?" team members then ask. The answer? Because the work is monotonous, noisy, and unchallenging. The ultimate resolution: to rethink the work process in order to reduce turnover. This, at last, is the ultimate cause, almost always an organizational problem. Once the difficulty is fixed, it's highly unlikely the problem will recur. In the process of repeatedly working through the five whys and in trying to find process improvements that reduce costs and boost profits, lean suppliers learn enormous amounts about practical paths to better manufacturing. Managing the relationship. A final feature of lean supply is the supplier associations, where all the first-tier suppliers to an assembler meet to share new findings on better ways to make parts. Toyota, for example, has three regional supplier associations: the Kanto Kyohokai, the Tokai Kyohokai, and the Kansai Kyohokai, with 62, 136, and 25 first-tier suppliers, respectively, in 1986. Nissan has two: the Shohokai and Takarakai, with 58 and 105 suppliers. Most of the other Japanese assemblers have supplier associations as well. In addition, many of the larger suppliers also have associations for their second-tier suppliers, for example, the Denso Kyoryokokai and Nippon Denso. Most of the main suppliers belong to these associations, which have been extremely important for disseminating such new concepts as statistical process control, SPC, and total quality control, TQC, in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Value analysis, VA, and value engineering, VE, later in the 1960s, and computer-aided design, CAD, in the 1980s. These meetings would never have been possible among mass production suppliers. They know that sharing any findings about how to make parts cheaper with less effort will only ensure that they lose the next bidding round to their rivals, or that they will win, but only with such a low bid that they can't make any money. So the process of improving production techniques becomes the job of professional engineering societies, such as the Institute of Industrial Engineers in the United States. The job gets done, but very indirectly and slowly. By contrast, suppliers to a lean producer know that as long as they make a good faith effort to perform as they should, the assembler will ensure that they make a reasonable return on their investment. So sharing with other group members means that the performance of the whole group will improve and every member will benefit. In other words, active participation in mutual problem solving through the supplier group is an act of simple self-interest. Before leaving this point, we should clear up an area of misunderstanding about lean supply. The frequent assumption in the West that all parts are sole-sourced in a lean supply system. That is, every part is supplied by only one supplier. This is generally true for large, complex systems that require massive investments in tools, transaxles, electronic fuel injection systems, engine computers, and so forth. But much less so for simpler parts. Lean assemblers do worry about how hard their suppliers will try, just as Toyota and other assemblers worry about sustaining the work pace in the assembly plant. There they stick with a seemingly antiquated continuous assembly line because it is a highly efficient pacing device. To make sure everyone tries hard continually, the assemblers usually divide their parts order between two or more members of their supplier group. The assemblers don't take this step to drive prices down. Remember that prices are not determined through bidding, but by mutual investigation between the assembler and a pre-designated supplier. Rather, they do it to prevent anyone letting down on quality or delivery reliability. When a supplier falls short on quality or reliability, the assembler does not dismiss the company, the normal method in the West. Instead, the assembler shifts a fraction of the business from that supplier to its other source for that part for a given period of time as a penalty. Because costs and profit margins have been carefully calculated on an assumed standard volume, shifting part of the volume away can have a devastating effect on the profitability of the uncooperative supplier. Toyota and other companies have found that this form of punishment is highly effective in keeping everyone on their toes, while sustaining the long-term relationship essential to the system. Lean producers do occasionally fire suppliers, but not capriciously. Suppliers are never kept in the dark about their performance, far from it. In fact, all the Japanese manufacturers maintain relatively simple supplier grading systems. The suppliers receive scores based primarily on the number of defective parts found on the assembly line, the percentage of on-time deliveries in the proper quantity and sequence, and performance in reducing costs. Suppliers regularly compare their scores with those of their competitors, discuss the findings, and highlight problem areas for attention, often with the help of engineers loaned from the assembler. The scoring system is not simply a statistical exercise. It also assesses the supplier's attitude and willingness to improve. Only if there is no sign of improvement will the supplier, in the end, be fired. As one assembler purchasing agent remarked in an interview, "We will stick with any supplier as long as we think they are making an earnest effort to improve. It's only when we think they have given up that we bring the relationship to an end." These then are the elements of lean supply. Rather than price, determined by the relative bargaining power of the two sides, as the main link with outside suppliers, and bureaucracy, as the chief link with in-house supply divisions, the lean assembler substitutes a long-term agreement that establishes a rational framework for analyzing costs, establishing prices, and sharing profits. It is therefore in the interest of all parties constantly to improve their performance by being completely open with one another, with neither party fearing that the other will take advantage of the situation exclusively for its own ends. The relationship between suppliers and assemblers in Japan is not built primarily on trust, but on the mutual interdependence enshrined in the agreed-upon rules of the game. However, a stable set of rules doesn't mean that anyone can slack off. Quite the opposite. It keeps everyone striving constantly to improve performance. Because lean producers are so successful in devoting much of the responsibility for engineering and making parts to suppliers, they tend to do much less themselves than in mass production companies. Of the total costs of the materials, tools, and finished parts needed to make a car, the Toyota Motor Company itself accounts for only 27%. The company produces 4 million vehicles per year with only 37,000 employees. General Motors, by contrast, adds 70% of the value in 8 million vehicles and needs 850,000 employees worldwide to do it. Part of the difference, to be sure, is that Toyota is more efficient in everything it does. A large part of the difference, however, is that Toyota and other lean producers do many fewer things. Clark and Fujimoto found, for example, that Japanese lean producers on average do detail engineering on only 30% of the parts in their cars. Detail engineering is the process of producing detailed drawings of parts that suppliers can then use to make the parts. The suppliers engineer the rest. During the early 1980s, by contrast, the American mass producers were performing detailed engineering on 81% of their parts. Yet these mass producers were still dealing with 3 to 8 times as many outside suppliers as Toyota. In other words, since the Americans were doing much more of the detail engineering and building a larger fraction of the parts they needed within the company, we would expect that the number of outside suppliers they would require would be much smaller. Instead, the situation is just the opposite. Even more striking, they needed a much larger purchasing staff. In 1987, GM had 6,000 employees in its parts purchasing operations, while Toyota had only 337. Reforming mass production supply systems. We've been talking so far as if the world has two types of supply systems, mass and lean, General Motors and Toyota. In fact, mass production supply systems no longer exist in their pure form, at General Motors or anywhere else. A decade of intensified competition and the introduction of many new technologies in automobiles have led to major changes in the way Western mass producers are treating their suppliers. We now hear a lot of talk about trust and partnership and single sourcing. The changes aren't just rhetorical, but they don't necessarily represent a shift toward lean supply either. To investigate the extent of these changes, IMVP researcher Richard Lamming visited the largest component suppliers and the assemblers' purchasing departments in Europe and North America. To supplement his extensive interviews, we also conducted a mail survey of suppliers in North America. The findings? Intensified competitive pressures have forced Western assemblers to look for further savings in their bills for components. Some assemblers facing a crisis, Chrysler in 1981, for example, simply resorted to across-the-board reductions in the prices they paid their suppliers. Others, however, tried to drive costs down over the long run by more fully exploiting economies of scale in parts production. This meant rationalizing their supplier structure and reducing the number of suppliers. This rationalization is well underway, as shown by the reduction in the number of suppliers by every mass producer during the 1980s, from a range of 2,000 to 2,500 at the beginning of the decade to between 1,000 and 1,500 at the end. The mass producers are trying to cut the number of suppliers to each assembly plant to between 350 and 500, and have largely reached this goal. This development occurred at the same time that many assemblers began to outsource the production of parts that could be produced more economically by specialist suppliers than by in-house divisions. Outsource, in car industry jargon, simply means buying a part from another company rather than making it yourself. In the early 1980s, for instance, Ford in the United States shut down its in-house wiring harness assembly operations and gave this business to 12 outside suppliers. Later in the decade, it reduced the number of suppliers to 4. Assemblers can reduce the number of suppliers in 3 ways. First, they can tier suppliers by assigning whole components to a first-tier supplier, seats, for example, as the Japanese do. This tack can reduce the number of suppliers from 25 to only 1, as we saw earlier. The assembler's administrative cost for coordinating supply plummets. Second, even without tiering, assemblers can cut the number of suppliers by reducing the parts count in components. In Chapter 4, we showed how front bumper assemblies in a GM car contained 10 times the parts of a similar assembly in a Ford car. So GM might also have 10 times as many suppliers to its assembly plant. Because cars and trucks are becoming more complicated, partly because of environmental demands and partly to satisfy consumers, there will always be a race between a growing number of vehicle systems and a declining number of parts per system. For the moment, however, parts counts are falling faster, with the result that assemblers are reducing the number of suppliers. Third, assemblers can single-source parts that previously had two or three suppliers. They can convert to single-sourcing within a traditional market context by soliciting bids, then giving all the business to the low bidder. The supplier who gets the entire business should then have greater economies of scale, and hence, lower prices. Respondents to our mail survey confirmed that single-sourcing was indeed a trend. On average, between 1983 and 1988, the number of suppliers producing a specific part for each American assembler fell from 2 to 1.5, and the number of suppliers producing the same general type of part for each assembler fell from 2.3 to 1.9. This is a sharp contrast with Japan, where multiple sourcing is the rule. The main reason assemblers go to single sourcing is to get longer production runs of a single component and avoid duplication of tooling. There's a downside to single sourcing as well, however. It leaves the assembler vulnerable to supply disruptions, as happened during recent strikes affecting Ford and Renault in Europe. Although many observers have argued that single sourcing is another useful technique Western assemblers can learn from the Japanese, we've already seen that this argument is both wrong and beside the point. These same observers assumed that single sourcing in Japan led to longer-term relationships with suppliers. In fact, as we saw, Japanese long-term relationships do not depend on single sourcing, but on a contract framework that encourages cooperation. Another change in the Western supply system is the shifting attitude toward quality among assemblers. All the U.S. assemblers have instituted a quality grading system for suppliers, not just on a shipment-by-shipment basis, but for all parts supplied over a considerable period. Ford started a systematic supplier grading system called Q1 in the mid-1980s. Q1 was followed shortly by the GM Spear program and Chrysler Pentastar. These are complex statistical systems that rank suppliers by the number of defects discovered in the assembly plant, delivery performances, progress in implementing quality, improvement programs in the supplier plant, level of technology, management attitudes, and more. The aim was to bring every supplier gradually up to higher and higher levels of performance and quality. These programs had a major impact in diffusing quality monitoring techniques, such as Statistical Process Control, SPC, to suppliers. With SPC, tool operators record the dimensions of each part or a sample of parts produced. If they notice these dimensions straying from what they should be, they either make the necessary adjustments to the machine, or, if it's a more difficult problem, such as a machine malfunction, call for help. In theory, no defective part should be produced. Part of the Q1 program involved going one step further and sharing these SPC charts with the assembler. Our mail survey showed that 93% of suppliers used SPC on all their operations in 1988, up from 19% in 1983. The Japanese began improving quality in their suppliers through the same process, though they diffused SPC to their suppliers in the late 1950s, some 30 years ago. Obviously, mass producers still have a long way to go. In fact, once suppliers use SPC systems for a while to identify when a machine is about to produce defective parts, find out why, and then take steps to ensure the problems don't recur, SPC becomes a routine activity for production workers, a point many Japanese companies reached in the mid-1960s. The next step in the path to lean supply, of course,